Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of December. First hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about the family and the family's ties to Uganda, and we'll go beyond that, too. As you are probably well aware, the anti-homosexuality bill of 2009 is being voted on in Uganda. Homosexuality has been illegal in that country for more than 100 years, and now the lawmakers are considering legislation that would go further. The bill is designed to eradicate homosexuality. It has strong support in the government and among evangelical Christians. Proponents of the bill link homosexuality to the West, and under the bill, Uganda would withdraw from any international treaties or protocols that recognize the human rights of gay people. There is a question, and we're going to explore that this hour, about Americans who are active in Uganda, a U.S. evangelical group that has been written about extensively by our guest this hour, called The Family, reportedly includes U.S. lawmakers who have shown great interest in the affairs of that country. The bill's proponents reluctant to talk about whether the family supports them in any way. And the Rwandan parliament is also voting on criminalizing homosexuality this week. Today, actually, the lower house of the Rwandan parliament will hold its final debate on a draft revision of the penal code that will make homosexuality a crime in that country. Joining us this hour is a gentleman who knows all about the family. He has written an extraordinarily fascinating book titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. It is a New York Times bestseller. It's now in paperback. And our guest, Jeff Charlotte, joined the family's home for young men at an estate in Virginia. He became a member of the family's new chosen, an elite cadre groomed by the family for Jesus and for power. He spent 5 years researching their roots and reported on the important role Christian conservative activism has played in American politics. And also, and he's been much on the news the last couple days because he's been looking at its influence in foreign affairs and in countries like Uganda. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, then you can do that, of course, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
What a fascinating book this is. You just can't put this one down. And partially because you went behind the scenes here, right? Because you know what's going on as much as anybody knows what's going on, because you joined him.
Well, I really sort of stumbled in. I was working on another book about religious communities around the United States, and through a strange set of circumstances, was invited to join this community. I didn't know that it was a political group at the time, and within a few days, Senator Jesse Helms, then around, this was some years ago now, came by for a visit. During my stay there, I met Senator John Ensign, the Nevada senator who became infamous this summer for his affairs and for the family's efforts to cover up those affairs at the C Street House, which is a property that they own in Capitol Hill. So I met all these politicians and realized it was a political organization, and left and continued researching, and they had dumped 600 boxes of papers in Billy Graham's archives, and so there was the whole record that allowed me to dig deep and tell the whole story.
Right. Let's start with the current news and then go backward in a way. Can you tell me, because Uganda is having this incredible vote, the anti-homosexuality bill, why the family, and we'll talk about who they are more, has an interest in Uganda and what role they may have in helping to fashion or support this piece of legislation?
Well, the first thing that's important for folks to understand is that Uganda is a very important country in the international scene, and I think there's a certain American provincialism that sometimes we hear about an African nation, and unless it's South Africa, we don't think of it as a major player. And of course, a lot of these countries are incredibly wealthy and resources. Uganda's recently discovered oil, but even more importantly, the dictator there, a guy named Museveni, has long been our sort of an American proxy for that entire region. Uganda is right there, and there's Rwanda next door. There's Congo, one of the most resource-rich nations in the world, which has been torn apart by civil war. There's Sudan, which also has oil. We see China now coming in and competing for access to the resources of these nations. There's something of a new quiet Cold War with China in Africa around these nations. There's, of course, the issue of terrorism and radical Islam in countries like Somalia, where, again, Uganda is our proxy. So Uganda is, it's important in that sense, and I think that's part of why the family cares about it. And in terms of fashioning the bill, it's not so much that the Americans went and fashioned the bill, as the Ugandan politicians who are behind this are actually members of this organization, their careers in some ways have been defined by it, starting right at the top with President Museveni, whose relationship with the family goes back to 1986 when he first took power, is referred to by members of the group as the key man for Africa. He's the point man for the continent, an incredibly influential figure. So it's not so much the influence of the Americans in terms of going to Uganda and saying, do this, it's Americans empowering and supporting their brothers as they put them in this organization in Uganda who are advancing this bill.
So why is this international focus important to members of the family? What's the end goal here?
Well, the family, it takes a word of explanation what it is. It's the oldest and most influential religious conservative organization in Washington. It's actually been quantified. A sociologist interviewed 350 top politicians and said which group is most influential. Family came out on top. But what makes them different than, you know, the old Christian coalition groups like that are a couple things. One, they aren't seeking publicity. The leader of the group, Doug Coe, says the more invisible you can make your organization, right, the more influence you can have. And there's the nature of that influence, which hasn't historically been so much about domestic politics as about foreign affairs. The two pillars of the group historically were what some in the group call biblical capitalism, the idea that capitalism is ordained by God, and two, this idea of an expansionist American power, that in fact, as you can expand the sphere of free market fundamentalism, you are opening the world to the gospel. And that's led them into relationships with countries all over the world, especially countries like Uganda, where they can have an outsized influence, where a couple of U.S. senators carry more weight than they would and another major player, another you know, powerful country. In a smaller country, Uganda's not that small, but in a smaller country that is dependent on the U.S. for foreign aid, someone like Senator James Inhofe, Senator Sam Brownback, guys who have traveled to Uganda with the family, they come as representatives of the most powerful nation of the world, and, you know, doors are going to be open and that country is going to listen.
Considering the amount of attention, although it's been recent attention, that has been placed on this anti-homosexuality bill, would it be safe to assume that Inhofe and Brownback have had knowledge of this for a long period of time and may have been helping to support this or not?
I don't think they're helping to support it. And in fact, there's been some interesting developments. I think when the news of this bill first came out, a lot of people linked it to a conference last March called the Kampala Conference, and there was a lot of leading American anti-gay Christian right activists, including a man named Scott Lively, wrote a book called The Pink Swastika, in which he argues that the Holocaust was a sort of a gay conspiracy. I mean, it's lunatic stuff, but unfortunately, it does have a pretty broad following, and he was even invited to address the Ugandan parliament, as were several other of these groups. Exodus, an organization that believes that they can cure people of homosexuality. So everyone thought that was the spark. And doing some reporting, working with some sources within the family, it turns out that the first time David Bahati, the Ugandan member of parliament who's behind the bill, first time he floated the idea was at a family event in October 2008, something called the Ugandan National Prayer Breakfast. And he floated the idea. What's interesting here is that there was some opposition. And now Senator Inhofe has been under pressure for a month. He's finally come out and denounced the bill. I don't believe Brownback has yet. Senator Grassley did after a long period of pressure, finally said, I'm against this bill. It's not so much that the Americans wanted to see that bill. It's a little bit more as if, since 1986, when Museveni came to power, some of these groups have been looking at Uganda as sort of a guinea pig on which they could sort of try out this sort of cultural transformation that they can never get across in the United States. And the guinea pig has grown up into a Frankenstein's monster. I don't think they envisioned a death penalty bill. This is what the bill would do. It would provide for the death penalty for various kinds of homosexual situations. But they created the monster, and then the question is, what are they going to do about it? The family's known about it for some time. I know Senator Inhofe knew about it for a month before he denounced it, because I and other journalists were trying to get him to comment on it. And they're not using their tremendous influence in that country. And the way that even someone like, say, Senator Russ Feingold put out a terrific statement on this. Now, he has no special influence in Uganda. He doesn't have a relationship with President Museveni. But he says, look, I contacted President Museveni and said, you know, United States is a big donor nation, and you need to back off this. That's the same kind of accountability we want to see with these guys who really do have sway. The good news is that there are some people within the family who are stepping up. And since I first started reporting on this, one sort of prominent family member, not a politician, but one of the sort of the organizers, got in touch with me, and he reported on what sounded almost like a, I don't want to say schism, but a real, there are folks in the group who say this goes too far.
Yeah, I would think so. I would hope so.
Yes, there are human beings, right? You know, I mean, it's a really, even the scope of the bill is so horrifying. You know, it's not just, it's death penalty for what they call aggravated homosexuality. And the definition is if you're HIV positive, even if you, you know, have sex with precautions and someone else knows it, it's death penalty. If you use alcohol in the pursuit of sex, it's a death penalty. In other words, if you, you know, go to a bar and buy a guy a drink and decide that you like each other and go home, it can be the death penalty for both of you. It extends to long prison terms if you know a gay person, friend or relative, and don't report them. Long prison terms. It also, the bill was designed on a couple levels. Early drafts said the bill was designed to be a model for other nations. So it's no surprise that we see this in Rwanda. We're starting to see some rumblings about this in Burundi. But it's also used as a way of leverage over foreign aid groups. You can be deported, or you can be even imprisoned. Suppose you are in Uganda and you're doing some kind of aid work. You're working with HIV people, maybe, or you're working on another issue, and government doesn't like what you're doing. All they have to do is look at your organization's charter, and if your organization's charter recognizes homosexuality as a human right, they can throw you in jail.
Oh, my. I was listening to an NPR report on the way to work this morning, and they were saying that the bill really has widespread support among Ugandans. Is that true?
It is. It is. And I think this is part of, this goes back to what I, when I sort of use that language of the guinea pig and the Frankenstein's monster, is that, look, Uganda has suffered horribly, you know, in decades. You know, everyone knows who Idi Amin was. He was followed by Milton Obote, another absolute monster. When Museveni came to power, he seemed like a real bright hope for Africa. You know, people, looking back now, people say with sadness that he could have been another Mandela. Instead, he immediately fell into this relationship with the family. And some of the people who were involved in that, I should say, did so with the best of intentions. But they started organizing the foreign aid. The first foreign aid for Uganda was organized by the family. This is by their own admission, that they sort of lobbied for this. And so that money was connected to these Christian right policies, and it sort of started drumming up a massive religious revival across Uganda. And American churches, mega churches, Rick Warren's church in particular, started being real big supporters of this massive religious revival. And at this point, you have a witch hunt kind of frenzy in Uganda. You have newspapers printing photographs, addresses, names of gay people, calling these kill lists. I mean, it's a nightmare situation.
Oh, Jeff, it is a nightmare situation. And then you've got a little bit of hypocrisy going on here. Some of the people who are members of the family have had their own problems with affairs, and I think that some of the descriptions in your book with their own sexuality, you know, not being sexless, but liking to dance, pulling their pants down kind of low, grabbing their crotches, et cetera. And some of it is pretty strange, to say the least.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, start with Senator Ensign.
Yes.
Who teamed up with Representative Joe Pitts, who's become well-known this summer for the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, the anti-abortion amendment. Pitts prefers to call it the Pitts-Stupak Amendment. Joe Pitts, Ensign, these guys were very involved several years ago when President Bush announced his $15 billion PEPFAR program for addressing AIDS around the world. Sounds like a good idea. They decide to use it, especially in Uganda. Uganda became the target nation. They decided to use it as a kind of a lever with which to change Ugandan policy. Now, Uganda had been a tremendous success story. They were the only country in Africa that actually turned the AIDS rate around. It was going down, and they did it with this three-part plan called ABC, abstinence, be faithful, and condoms. Condoms are a very important part of that. Joe Pitts and John Ensign, who wants to be free to pursue his own sexual interests, did not think that Ugandans should have access to condoms. And as a result, there's now health reports coming out. Well, the most clearest indicator is the AIDS rate turned around again. It started climbing again in Uganda. Now Ugandan health officials describe PEPFAR, this program that U.S. was giving money to design to fight AIDS, they describe it as a death blow for Uganda. It's accompanied by this religious revival in which the First Lady of Uganda, a very powerful woman, I mean, the dictator's been in office since 23 years. The First Lady is herself a power in the country, and also is, by the way, very involved in the family. Both the president and his wife travel to the United States frequently and spend time with the family. She has been urging this campaign of fertility, that Ugandans have to have as many kids as they can to compete economically, and that birth control, condoms, will cause birth defects.
Oh,
and as a result,
goodness,
we now have a country where you have a whole generation of people who aren't even aware of these possibilities. It's these American politicians like John Ensign, Jim Inhofe, Joe Pitts, taking their own moral and political agendas, using the force, the cudgel, the club of American generosity overseas to impose their ideas on a country. And, you know, they don't really care about the results.
Well, they're being forced to now, at least publicly, say something.
They are. And I think that's one of the, you know, another great aspect of this story, I think, that is important, is that there's been a number of conservative evangelical activists who have taken the point. There's one I really call attention to, Dr. Warren Throckmorton at I believe it's called Grove Hill College, a Christian college. And Dr. Throckmorton's a conservative evangelical. He, I don't think, supports homosexuality, but he will fight to the death against any of these kinds of laws, any kind of criminalization of homosexuality. And he has been putting the heat on. I think he is in large part responsible for Pastor Rick Warren, the mega church pastor, who had been so involved with Uganda. A big supporter of the Ugandans who are being in this bill. His first reaction was he had no comment. And then finally he's come out and denounced it. But even, you know, what's interesting is my source in the family, a man named Bob Hunter, the guy who actually back in 1986 helped build the relationship with the dictator Museveni, and who is doing the right thing now, is trying to use his influence to stop the bill, said he had reached out to the family's friends on Capitol Hill, guys like Inhofe and so on. And their response was they didn't want to interfere in the internal affairs of this country.
Oh, my gosh.
They've been doing nothing but for 10 years.
Oh, my gosh. Let's welcome phone calls. We have a lot of people who want to speak with you, Jeff. We're speaking with the author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeff Charlotte is our guest. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. There are two stories at work here. I'd really like to have Jeff on again because part of what we're looking at and the reason that he has been very much all over the news, Jeff has the last few days, is because he wrote the book about The Family. It is tied to what's going on in Uganda, where they are voting on the anti-homosexuality bill of 2009. The Family has been very involved in Uganda for a long period of time. And we're talking, and obviously members would know about what's going on here. And you've heard the story of how they have taken their concerns and experimented in a country like Uganda. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple things to tell you about. Number one is we're going to be interviewing Carl Castle. I am actually later this morning, and we're going to post that interview. He's retiring. I remember taking that. I'm a Facebook fan now, as you know, but that quiz that they had, which NPR personality are you? And a number of my friends came up with Carl Castle, and I was as well. So that's kind of fun. We'll talk about that with him. It's going to be posted on Facebook. And we're asking, Rhonda has this good idea. She has a lot of good ideas. But if you could ask him one question, what would it be? Because we won't have our audience interaction with Carl. So if you can post it on Facebook, just go to, you know, Facebook and then The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we'll use your questions, okay? And then we'll post it on Facebook and have this whole interactive community. Second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with the author of The Imperial Cruise. James Bradley will be joining us. He talks about a lost history of 1905 when a U.S. contingent of members of Congress, led by Theodore Roosevelt, Secretary of War, the later President William Howard Taft, went to Asia. And it's a disturbing story, underreported story of that part of American history, including the atrocities in the Philippines. So that's coming up. All right, let's go to phone calls for Jeff. Jeff Charlotte, author of The Family, is our guest. Karen from New Berlin is our first caller, Jeff. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kathy. I don't quite know where to start because I have quite a few things I'd like to say. First, I heard about the book, The Family, listening to NPR, so I'm very grateful to have been directed that way. I have missed the news the last couple days because too many Christmas preparations. So I didn't hear about this law in Uganda. I am reading the book. And the question that I have is that I find it extremely hard to figure out what our country is truly doing in the U.S., but also overseas. You know, Chalmers Johnson talks about building empire, and this book ties right into that. But, of course, their motivation is clear. Excellent, excellent information. And the question that I have is, seeing the amount of power that is held within the family, what are the chances that somebody like a new president who has a different agenda can succeed in the context of this kind of opposition? That's my question.
Okay.
Well, that's a great question. You know, the interesting thing about The Family is that unlike other Christian right organizations, they've always sought a certain level of bipartisanship. The leader of the group says, we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. And that's allowed them to endure for 70 years. They go back to the 1930s when they began as a sort of anti-New Deal coalition. But over time, they sort of swallowed up some Democrats. Bart Stupak, you know, out from sort of your corner of the country there, Democrat, Michigan, has been living in their C Street house for 7 years. There are other Democrats involved. So in that sense, it makes them very hard to oppose. And I think they've really sort of masters of the banal, you know. Their only public event every year is called the National Prayer Breakfast.
Which is a big deal, right?
It's a big deal. Going back to 1953, Bart Stupak, in fact, has been trying to put out some misinformation there because he's one of the organizers of it, one of the guys who decides who gets to go. And one of the questions is, in fact, whether the men who are promoting this gay death penalty bill are coming in February. But it goes back to 1953. Eisenhower was the first to attend. Every president has attended since. Eisenhower didn't like it. Eisenhower says it was a violation of the First Amendment, but he owed political favors, so he went. He said, I hope it won't become a tradition. It did. The only person with the gumption to not go was Jackie Kennedy, who said, not a chance, I'm not going. But every president has to go, and Obama went too. And you know, the reality is that when you look at an organization like this, the power becomes so entrenched, and frankly, the media becomes lazy, and we have a media right. that's also rather religiously illiterate. So if someone says, well, I'm involved in a prayer group, everyone says, well, prayer, that's good, that's innocuous. The question is, what are you praying for? You know, there's more questions to follow, and those are respectful questions. Those are questions sure. that respect freedom of religion. A politician says, I am informed by my faith. The respectful question is, tell us more about your faith. And when we encounter the faith of the family sort of fetishizes power, as I've reported, they frequently invoke the leadership lessons to be learned from a very unholy trinity, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And they'll say these are evil men, but they understood power. What can we learn from that? I think the Christian answer, and these guys do style themselves Christian, the Christian answer would probably be nothing. But they take a different approach. I think, the caller says, what can you do about resisting this? I guess I think that's the implication of that question. I think it's happening now. And there's been a lot of challenges around the country. Local press is doing a great job. Down in Oklahoma, there's some reporters who are really hounding Jim Inhofe. Out in Kansas, we've got even TV News. It's been a long time since TV News did tough investigative political
yes.
reporting. But they're doing it in Kansas, in Michigan, and Nevada, of course, where John Ensign is, and in South Carolina, where Mark Sanford also linked with the group. There's all this kind of reporting going on. And that pressure is leading to this moment where the family is starting to crumble. Some people are trying to get away from their C Street house. Some politicians who got involved with good intentions are starting to ask questions about just what it is they're involved in. And we are starting to see some glimmers of accountability.
So what are they, when you were there and involved in these prayer circles they had, what were they praying for?
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, they described, Mark Sanford described it as Bible studies that he was going up to at the C Street house. Mark Sanford, you know, with the affair this summer, governor of South Carolina, said he was going hiking on the Appalachian Trail and was actually going to see his mistress. And and as in the case of Senator John Ensign and also former Congressman Chip Pickering, the family helped cover up these affairs. You know, at the Bible studies, what's interesting about the Bible studies is there's very little Bible, almost none. And in fact, there's a Christian right magazine called World, and they have been doing some tough reporting on the family now, too. They're very fundamentalist, but you know, they believe in transparency. They believe in democracy like the rest of us. They don't like this. And they're reporting that in these Bible studies, the same thing that I saw, that it's a little bit, if you get a group of guys together, very powerful men, and it'll be all men because they sort of have this idea that prayer is most effective when it's gender segregated and men should be in charge. There's this idea of male headship. These guys get together and say, what does Jesus want us to do about Social Security? What does Jesus want us to do about this financial issue? What does Jesus? The answer has almost always historically been privatized. Jesus really wants privatization. But it's never put in this direct way. Sam Brownback gave me a good example of how it works. One man might say to another, I have Jesus put a message on my heart that Senator Brownback, that you should do some work with the Central Asian republics. Out of that grew the idea for something called the Silk Road Act, which would funnel foreign aid to the Central Asian dictators. As Brownback's people explained it to me, that would open up those countries to American investment and notable among those companies interested in that would be something called Koch Industries, his big financial backer. And the gospel would follow American dollars. And he doesn't see that as cynical, because if everybody gets rich, that's a sign that God approves of what you're doing.
Jesus would, I'm seeing this as a bumper sticker, Jeff. Jesus wants us to privatize, which would certainly catch my attention as I was driving around, because yeah. I would think that maybe Jesus, to a lot of people, would want the exact opposite. I could be wrong, but this is an amazing story, isn't it? It's just amazing. Thank you very much for your call, Karen. Pat from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I was just wanting to say, you know, it's disturbing enough when these fanatics are trying to run our country, let alone when they start interfering in the politics of other countries. And I just kind of wondered how your guest maintained his sanity during the whole time.
Well, it was a, you know, I only lived with him for a short while, about a month, but then spent 5 years in their archives and traveling around and interviewing them and spending time with those who would talk to me and talking to former members and so on. And you know, the interesting thing about this story that I think actually helps one maintain sanity and perspective and also a little hope is that you recognize that so many people involved in this get involved with deep sincerity and good intentions. And it becomes a tragic story because of what might result from that. I mean, I even look at someone like Bart Stupak, Congressman Stupak, who I understand has been having some choice words for me on my reporting. And I think Stupak feels like, look, you know, he's not a rabid right-winger. He's a conservative Democrat, but not a rabid right-winger. He gets involved with this thing. He's trying to do something good. They have this idea that you can work behind the scenes to bring reconciliation around. As one man explained to me, he says, look, you know, I have seen the president of Rwanda and the president of Congo weep at the family's headquarters in Arlington. I've seen them, they'll hug each other and weep. These are two warring countries. And it sounds wonderful, and you're moved until you do your homework and you say, hey, the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, the president of Congo, Joseph Kabila, these men are killers. I mean, these are astonishing killers. And when we reinforce their power, we may have a touching hallmark moment, but in fact, we've just, with the best of intentions, gone in and made the situation worse. But if you remember that tension between trying to do good and through your sort of see no evil approach to things, actually achieving terrible things, you can keep your sanity because you know where the story started and you know what brought people into it, and you recognize that there's some hope because at the beginning, there was a better idea.
What's Tupac saying about you? I want to hear.
We actually cannot say it on the air.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, what's interesting about it, and Stupak, Pitts, Chuck Grassley, all these guys have started denying any involvement with the group. And Stupak, he's been living at the C Street house, the family C Street house. It's a former convent, registers a church, not anymore as a result of our reporting this summer. It lost its tax-exempt status.
Oh, it
but
did.
And he gets subsidized housing there. And Stupak's known this for 7 years, but now he refers to the C Street house as a stink bomb. But at the same time, he's saying, "Well, I have nothing to do with any of this. I didn't know there's any prayer going on in the house. It's registered as a church. I've been in the house. It's a place of prayer." The question is, what do they pray for? Joe Pitts saying, "I've never heard of this group." Chuck Grassley, Senator Chuck Grassley, has a stack of documents in their archives linking Chuck Grassley to the Somali dictator Saad Barre, for whom he helped organize. Just one of the bloodiest stories in the family's history. This is a lunatic dictator, and Grassley, working with an American defense contractor, arranged meetings with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Somalia's defense budget was massively expanded. The dictator turned the guns on his own people and destroyed the country.
Oh my gosh.
Never recovered to this day.
Yes.
Grassley, the documents are there. Anyone can go look at them. He's saying, I don't know anything about it. When I took this to the family, I said, you know, Senator Grassley's actually denying that he had anything to do with you. So is Joe Pitts. they themselves were saying, well, it's not true. So there's a problem with Stupak's denials and Pitt's denials and Grassley's denials, which is that the documents tell a different tale.
Exactly. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. The author of The Family is with us this hour, Jeff Charlotte. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have a couple emails. We'll get to those right after this pause. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to an email from Dave in Appleton. My son, who's been working in Uganda for 2 years, told me about the AIDS policy this week. The other effect of reporting others is to take political opponents out of the races for months before and after elections.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. I mean, legislation like this, I think one has to recognize it comes from, the raw bigotry and hatred, but it always has a political purpose. And Museveni, the dictator himself, acknowledges this, and when you look at the course of his career, when he came to power, he wasn't talking about gay folks. That wasn't an issue for him. And it's as the years have gone on, as he's amended the Constitution so he can stay in power, he's shut down media, he's thrown opponents in jail, and so on. More and more, he turns to issues like this. So instead of looking at Museveni and the corruption of his regime, he gets the people riled up, and he says, there's a gay conspiracy to take over the nation, and we all have to band together. I mean, it is, there's the F word that we can say on the air, which is fascism, and you should almost be very careful in using it. I think a lot of political discourse, people throw the word around too lightly. This fascism is a very strong thing, and just because you don't like, say, a conservative politician doesn't make them a fascist. But when, as Uganda is, you are talking about hunting out a whole segment of the population and killing them and identifying them as a foreign other. And the idea is, Museveni says that Uganda didn't have a gay problem until the Europeans came, and that Europeans sneak into Uganda and recruit homosexuals. This is the same rhetoric that was on the air in the Rwandan genocide, the idea of an other as alien that needs to be exterminated and hunted out. And even fascist is not big enough a word. It's a potentially genocidal scheme.
Right. And what about in the United States? Are there efforts by this group to work against gay marriage? Do you have evidence that they are working here in some way?
Well, the family is interesting because they, unlike other Christian right groups, they don't. There's no website. They don't say here's our set of issues, and that's a way. And they'll say, hey, we don't take positions. We just sort of offer worldviews. So now, you take on the issue of say of abortion. This is a telling one because there's some documents in the archives. Joe Pitts, again, Congressman Pitts, has been a leader in the anti-abortion fight. Says he has nothing to do with the family. There's documents in the archives in which they say, look, we're going to pledge the support of the family quietly to your anti-abortion work. And so they'll pursue things that way. But even within the group, there's not a lockstep orthodoxy. They prefer access to orthodoxy. But the influence has been to support politicians like Inhofe and Brownback and so on, who are the real spine of the membership, who, of course, are opposed to these things, are some of the leading opponents. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who is perhaps the angriest anti-gay politician in the United States, and another guy who is interested in expansion of the death penalty. Some people may remember that Senator Coburn some time ago publicly mused on perhaps we should extend the death penalty to abortion providers. And then, of course, when someone decided to take matters in their own hands in Kansas with Dr. George Tiller, did Senator Coburn take accountability for his words? No, he had nothing to do with it. It's that kind of lack of just character that is so troubling that when you look at a group like Pat Robertson's group or James Dobson's group, these famous Christian right groups that we know, some listeners may disagree with them. You know that you disagree with them because they're operating in the public square. They go out and they say, this is how we think society should be organized. And we can have that debate. You might not like their views. You might think their views are hateful. But they do so in a democratic fashion. And that's the real difference here.
Right. Connie from Madison. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I'd like to bring us back a little bit to their theology of personal holiness, because I think that it fits well with this autocratic leader run amok in Africa that you've been talking about. It seems that the theology of the recent leader of this, and I can't remember his name.
70, yeah.
Yeah, no, not Africa, of the family.
Oh, Doug Coe.
Has a notion that God chooses leaders, and their personal holiness is beside the point, and he points apparently to King David as a good example of a flawed person whose leadership is not in question, and therefore, within the family, the sexual peccadilloes of various members seems not to be within the family seen as an indication of a fall, but rather as an entitlement to, because their leadership doesn't depend on their personal sanctity or holiness. There's no notion that they're on some sort of a spiritual path to becoming better people in that way. Could you comment on that?
Well, in fact, that's a story I tell in the book, and it's actually sort of what dragged me back in the conversation. At the beginning of the summer, when Senator Ensign and Sanford were in their affairs, I didn't want to comment on it. I'm not as interested in these issues of personal hypocrisy. I care more about maybe what's going on in Uganda. But then Governor Sanford said he was not going to step down because he was like King David. King David had done bad things, but he wasn't so much elected to his position as selected by God. And this was a story, in fact, that I encountered when I was living with a family. David Coe is the son of Doug Coe, the leader and sort of heir apparent, had come around and spoken to the young men, and he wanted to explain the importance of the King David story, and he did so by pointing to one young man and saying, and it's reminding everybody that King David did some bad things. Remember the Bible story. He seduces another man's wife and then arranges to have the husband killed so that he can have her all to himself. So David Coe, trying to explain the meaning of this, why you would emulate this, points to a young man and says, suppose I hear you rape three little girls, what would I think of you? And the young guy, being a human being, says, you think I'm a monster.
Right.
And David Coe says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. You're chosen for leadership. Now, in the American context, you look at something like Governor Sanford, and we just see a striking lack of personal responsibility and accountability. It's bad for the state of South Carolina. South Carolina will suffer for that. In the international context, with President Museveni, whom the family reached out and cultivated going back to 1986 and has been supporting in power ever since, the implications are truly, truly horrifying.
Yes, they are. You have to be recommended to be a member of this organization. Is your character part of the consideration here, Jeff?
No. Your power is.
Your power.
And they'll say that, speaking with a family source just the other day, and he's sort of trying to defend what they do, he says, of course we work with a lot of bad people, because leaders are bad people. And there's a sense, there's all that, in that sense, there's a hopelessness to their theology. They can't imagine a kind of a democratic effort where the leaders are not in charge. People are in charge. We hold the leaders accountable. But their idea is that a dictator like Museveni or Kagame and Rwanda, Kabila and Congo, and this extends around the world, they were great supporters of the dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, killed 1.2 million of his own people. The family never said a word. They knew what he was doing. The whole world knew what he was doing. They said, well, he's chosen for his position by God. He's a bad man, but that's just the way it is. There are different democratic models. There's different theological models out there. And that's why even there's a lot of conservative Christians who say, hey, this is not what the Bible teaches.
Right.
We don't have to simply accept the authority of bad men over us. The tension within the family, and I return to this guy Bob Hunter, who I do like to call attention to because he's within the family, he's fighting this bill, he's doing the right thing. He said there's always struggled with a tension between access and accountability. You want access to the powerful so that you can influence them. If you gain that access, well, it kind of becomes hard to hold them accountable. You have access to the dictator Museveni. James Inhofe does. He goes and meets over there. He says he's adopted Uganda. Now, if he was to go charging in and say, Ms. 70, you're doing a terrible thing here, maybe Ms. 70 doesn't want to listen to him anymore.
Right.
They've lost the real core of their own religious tradition, which is to speak truth to power, which is to listen to the whole tradition of the prophets and both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament and recognize that your role is not to support the powerful, more power for the powerful, which is where the group began. They believe that God gave them a vision that they were to do this, but to challenge power, and they just don't do it. And the end result can be something like Somalia destroyed, or Indonesia, American
terrible
money for guns, or
right.
Uganda.
Yeah, how in the world did they let you into this group?
Oh, well, there's the good news. There's a certain clumsiness to
right.
to the. I mean, you know, as a first, I should say, I didn't know that it was a political group when I went in. A friend had asked me to speak with her brother, whom she was afraid had joined a cult, and I'd known the man for years, and he said, you won't understand it unless you see it for yourself. And I said, well, you know, I don't share your beliefs. And he said, that's okay. You don't need to share my beliefs. You just need to obey. This is about obedience. Belief is not particularly important to us. And so I just sort of walked in the front door under my own name. You know, I was a writer. I always thought my feelings were a little hurt that they weren't interested in my writing. You know, I was like,
oh, they are
now.
Don't
you guys want to know what I write? Because maybe you wouldn't like it. They did let me in, and I think there's also an element of the conversation with them continues to this day. They really believe they're doing the right thing. They believe that if you just saw what they were doing, you would support it. And if some bad things have happened, like Somalia or some of the work they did in South Africa and so on, well, that's ancient history, and they shouldn't be held responsible for that. And it's that, that's not the banality of evil. It is the evil of banality.
Mm-hmm. Connie, thank you so much for your great points. Paul from Duluth, hi.
Good morning. My jaw is hitting the floor, so I hope you can hear me okay. I have a dilemma and then a question, and I'll try to be brief. In the 2008, leading up to the 2008 election, I called my 90-year-old aunt in the UP of Michigan, which is Bart Stupak's district, and I had seen him on speaking on C-SPAN, and I thought, boy, this is one sharp guy. I don't remember what he was talking about. And I was talking to my aunt, and she said, well, I don't know who I'm going to vote for president, so maybe I won't vote at all. And I said, well, Bart Stupak's a pretty sharp guy, so when you go to vote for him and vote for Barack Obama at the same time, which is what she ended up doing. I don't know how I'm going to explain this all to her right now. But the other thing is, I understand Sam Brownback is retiring from the Senate, and I'm wondering if he's going to be kind of a loose cannon and what kind of damage he can do. I mean, I think he's a very dangerous person.
As far as Bart Stupak, I think the question for Bart Stupak is, he seems a conservative Democrat, as I understand that area. He represents the general sentiments of his district pretty well. The question for him is, he says he didn't know about the subsidies for his housing and all this stuff. He didn't know about this stuff. The question is, now that you know, what are you going to do about it? There's no sense here that you can't be in. Look, if these guys want to be involved in the family, that's fine. Just be upfront about it. Stupak was very involved, according to family sources, in deciding who gets to go to the prayer breakfast. That's a decision that they describe as strategic, because it's a week-long lobbying fest. One clue to that is the fact that the foreign delegations are often led by defense ministers who are here looking for guns and butter. So, people ask those tough questions of Stupak, and that's the way to do it. That's the way democracy works. Brownback more interesting case. There's a whole chapter in the book dedicated to Brownback. Brownback is such a sincere believer. Even knowing who I was, he was sure that if I just understood him better, I would love him. And so he invited me into his home and to his church and to his Washington office. I think he has a lot of potential as a powerful person in the future. He is resigning from the Senate. He's running unopposed for governor, and that is part of his plan. He still dreams of seeking the presidency. Stepping up to replace him is a race between two congressmen, a guy named Jerry Moran, Republican, and a guy named Todd Tehart, Republican. Jerry Moran lives in the family C Street house, and Todd Tehart goes there for spiritual counseling sessions. I sat in on one of them where he talked about his feeling that Muslims are having too many babies. He's a fairly bigoted man. But you see in that situation, it's a little bit heads the family wins, tails they win.
Right.
And Brownback continues to consolidate what is frankly such a vicious political machine in Kansas. I was just out there in Kansas, and I was hosted by a group of Democrats and Republicans. These are traditional Republicans who say, you know, this isn't what our party was supposed to be about, this kind of bullying, culture war, aggressive tactics.
We got to go. You're great. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks. Jeff Charlotte, the book is in paperback right now, well worth a read. It is a gripping story, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for answering your phone calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but that's the way it is. We have news coming up, and we'll return with another hour of conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.